Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and today we are back with another episode of the My Side series. Too often football is seen as tribalistic, as fans display blinkered obsession for their football team and make outlandish claims via terrorist chants that their team is by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. However, within these claims of blind faith and devout following lies eras and teams which crystallise why supporters love their team or are prepared to suffer the recurring heartache. On even rarer occasions, you find a fan of football who can see the beauty and excellence in a side who lies beyond the confines of their own club's history. My Side is an in-depth discussion with a different guest each episode about a side that made an eternal impression upon them. Either a club side over a single season or an international side at a major championships, discussing the key protagonists, the major incidents, the legacy and much more. My Side is the personal story of a love affair between a football fan and a side that defines their love of the beautiful game. Delighted to say that joining us once more is Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
We're very well, thanks, Stu. Very well indeed. How's it going, Joran?
Yeah. Not too bad, not too bad. Although, gotta say, quite interested on this one. Are you how are you feeling about this one? Obviously, after last week's episode, this one's going to be slightly different for you.
Dubious pleasure to call this one. Dubious pleasure.
a dubious pleasure.
Yes.
That's all right. That's probably nicely put. I'm assuming you'll be able to see the beauty in it. Begrudgingly.
Oh, yeah. You can't, though. You know, and that's the thing. The similarities and the parallels between my team and this team and, you know, how they came to prominence and that concept of evolution and keeping a successful arc going, you know, no matter, you know, they might be, you know, my polar opposite as such, but at the same time, I can see it's that mirror image almost, you know, and so... To completely take against something that reflects something that you love, then you've got to find the joy in that. You've got to find the love of that.
That's very magnanimous of you. I'm very impressed.
Whether it stays that way is not a matter. give me 20 minutes.
You've started.
You might find the signal goes.
Although I'll tell you what, when I was looking at this, I cannot believe where the time has gone from the season we're going to be chatting about.
It's pretty mad, isn't it? Where does time go? And that's quite frightening, really, that it's two decades since this team, you know, reached the heights that we'll be talking about tonight.
It was probably the most surprising. It was the most surprising thing of all, I think.
It's startling. I mean, that's the fact, because it's remembering not very little, but you think of how much football has gone, you know, under the water since then.
Yeah.
But how much you've actually kind of like absorbed and you remember. You know, I'll find it harder to remember much of the football in the 20 years since this than it did in the 20 years prior to that.
It is. I'm not saying it seems like yesterday, but yeah, I was absolutely staggered that this was two decades ago.
Because I've looked at, you know, I've just had a quick look up, because you do that, you try and remember games and players who were involved and, you know, the chronology of how players, you know, left and joined the team. And I'm looking at the list of some of the players that were around then and signed there, and I still see them as youngsters. You know, it's mad.
Yeah,
it's mad. I see a name and think, yeah, they're just kind of like, you know, still 23 or 22 or 21, and you know, clearly they're not. You know, mad.
It is. So I'm delighted to say, on your behalf, Stephen, I'm delighted to say that tonight we're going to be talking about what is arguably English football's greatest ever side. It is certainly the most successful side in terms of trophies won in a single season. I think that's beyond doubt. Tonight we're talking about Manchester United's treble winning 1998-1990 side. So it's a big welcome to Mr. Dan Williamson. Dan, how are you, sir?
Hi, Stuart. Yeah, I'm very good, thanks, mate. And it's been a while for me on the podcast, so glad to be back chatting to you two guys.
It's been too long. But I've also got to say, when we were coming up with this series, you were the very first person that I thought of when I was thinking about this, when we were thinking about this series and what sides people might pick and, you know, and who might pick which sides. You didn't disappoint me with the side you picked. And it's taken a little while to get you here, but yeah, you were the sort of the number one thought when I was thinking about this.
And I must say, Stephen, you're a better man than I am, because I don't think I could go on a podcast and talk about Liverpool for an hour.
Well, that's it. You owe me one after this.
You've got the air of a sort of a politician, you know.
Yeah, you owe me big time for this one.
Okay. So first of all, Dan, obviously, you know, you've been on before. People will know, certainly people who read your work will know you very well, the work you do with These Football Times. But if you could just give us a little bit of sort of background about yourself, your sort of your love affair with football, and how it came to pass that you are a Manchester United fan.
Yeah, just from family, being a kid, really. You know, dad, granddad's all supporting the team. Grew up about 4 or 5 miles away from Old Trafford as the crow flies. So just a no-brainer, really. And yeah, I think your love affair with football probably does stem for a lot of people from the team you grew up supporting. I was really lucky that I was born at a time I was in terms of the club. So my first game was in 91. So, you know, just as the sort of the success under Ferguson is really starting to kick in is when I was sort of 8 years old. In 91, I was eight. So those kind of formative teenage years when I was, falling in love with football was pretty good time, pretty good timing, really, in terms of the success for United.
I don't want to say you were lucky, but I suppose you were there literally, right at the start. It can't be levelled at you. That you're a Glory supporter, clearly. Like you say, it was all just about to start, rather than well on its way. So obviously there's been a lot, certainly, you know, under Sir Alex Ferguson, there was a lot of successful Manchester United sides. Obviously we can go back to the sides of Matt Busby, but I suppose really just introduce a little bit about this side and this particular season that we're going to talk about.
Well, I think there had been good sides before. You know, Ferguson had built a good side. I mean, a lot of people talk about the 94 team being the best that he built. There were trophies won in pretty much every season from the FA Cup final in 1990 all the way up until this. But I don't know. I mean, in terms of it being different, I think for me it was just I was 15 at the start of the season, and it's kind of like, you know, those sort of teenage years where, you know, your music, your film tastes, they all sort of, a lot of it for a lot of people stem from those years. So it was just kind of perfect timing for me in terms of being 15, 16. I was old enough then where I could go to the game on my own. So it was the first season where I was able to go to, you know, a dozen home games or whatever without parents. So I'd go with mates and I could go more often. Whereas, you know, when you're younger, you have to go, you know, you have to get a parent to take you. And so in terms of like personally, it was just perfect timing like that. In terms of the team, I think it was just kind of a culmination, you know, that Fergie had been building a team. And I know it was the sort of second iteration of his great teams, but it was just like almost like inevitable, you know, that the club was going to have a European Cup success. I know that like anything can happen in a European Cup, you know, it's a cup game at the end of the day, but it just felt that it was building to something, you know, over the course of the decade.
I mean, it's funny you should say that. I was just getting my first question ready for Stephen. My first question for Stephen was, do you think there was an air of inevitability that this season would eventually happen under Sir Alex Ferguson?
Yeah, maybe not that specific season. I don't think you could be as specific as that.
No,
but I think
but
it was just a case
season.
Of, yeah, it was building towards it. It was going to happen. I think after, was it 97 and they came to within a game? Was it Dortmund? beat them in what was effectively the semi-final, I think, if I've got that right.
It was 97, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was like an actual semi-final. I can't remember the format of it, was whether it was like a group decide, because I know they did them in groups.
No, it was the semi-final, and
was it like 1-0 in both games or something like that, wasn't it? I think I felt it was going to happen that year, to be honest. So I think after that, and they didn't do it then, it was just a case of a matter of time. It was going to happen. It was just when.
Yeah, and I think just to touch on a point that you mentioned there, Stephen, about, yeah, I don't think it was necessarily sort of written in the stars that it would be this season, because I think if you remember, Arsenal won the double the season before, and they were looking absolutely frightening. You know, they had Mark Overmars on the wing. He was just incredible. You know, the pace he had on the wing. You know, they just had a really good balanced side, and they won the double the year before, and they were coming to the fore under Wenger. So right at the start of the season was the Charity Shield. I went to that game. That was like my first trip to the old Wembley. And Arsenal won 3-0. And I know Charity Shield is not always the, you know, you can't really sort of set your watch by it, you know, making sense of what's going to happen in the course of the season. But, you know, it was 3-0. It was comprehensive beating. And you know, coming home on the coach that day, you just kind of felt that Arsenal were going to steamroll the league, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd just add to that is that I think it's a testament to what Manchester United did that season, is that I always felt that Arsenal were better that season than they were in the previous season when they did the double. There was that air of confidence about them, and I really do think they played far better football in 98-99 in not win than they did the previous year in winning the double.
Yeah, possibly.
You know, we talked about Alex Ferguson's ability to, you know, to regenerate and build new sides. So I suppose, you know, having talked about Arsenal this, you know, the season before and looking so ominous, but you know, Alex Ferguson's an incredibly intelligent football man, so would have foreseen the Arsenal threat for this coming season, for the 98-99 season. So what, in terms of preparation, in terms of the movement of players, did he do in preparation for this season?
So in terms of the players, made three signings. I think in total it was about 30 million quid. And it's crazy when you think back, and I know like 20 years has passed now since then, but I remember Martin Edwards, the chairman, doing a press conference, and you know, they asked him about the spending, and he sort of like almost sighed and puffed his cheeks out, and then you know, gave a little wry smile as if to say, you know, bloody hell, we've spent a lot of money here, and it was 30 million quid in total. So crazy when you sort of think about the fees of today, but it's just different times, isn't it? He bought three players in, Jaap Stam, who he didn't get off to the best start. I remember at the Charity Shield, he got absolutely done by Anelka for one of the goals. And he was only a few games in, and people were kind of thinking, is this guy good enough, you know, coming from Holland, where it's not as quick paced and obviously the quality is not as high. And he struggled initially to settle in, but obviously turned out to be absolutely superb. Jesper Blomqvist came in, so he was one that was kind of not massive. I mean, he was you know, well known as a decent player, but I think he was a great signing as well in terms of cost and what he gave to the team. Didn't always start, he wasn't in sort of favoured starting 11, but he could come on either wing, and he carried the ball really well. And I think he was just a good lad to have around as well. And then the other one was Dwight York. He came in sort of late on in the sort of, I think the season had already started actually when he was sort of finalised. And according to the papers, I don't know how true it all is, but the club was linked with pretty much every major striker in Europe. You know, Batistuta, Kluivert. Trying to think of Marcelo Salas as well, he was another one. They were linked with everyone, and Dwight York coming in sort of late on, it almost felt like it was kind of, you know, plan B kind of thing. A lot of people thought he was overpriced at 12.6 million. Fergie said that he tried to sign him in 95, but he signed a new contract with Villa, so Fergie's obviously had him on his radar. But yeah, I think a lot of people were sort of a bit, you know, oh, is this it kind of thing, after all those names that have been linked with. But again, he was another one that sort of just turned out to be perfect, you know, the final piece of the jigsaw. The one other great boost was Keane coming back from injury. So he missed basically whole of the 97-98 season with the injury picked up against Leeds, the one which became famous later for the Alfie Haaland incident. That was the season before. So he'd basically been out of the team for a year. So him coming back, I know it's a bit of a sort of cheesy cliche, but it was almost like a new signing.
I mean, when you get to the semi-finals against Juventus, I think Roy Keane, I think the return of Roy Keane just actually shows just what a crucial player he was for Manchester United.
Yeah, absolutely. So having him back after a year out is absolutely massive. Again, it was a bit of a baptism of fire, that Charity Shield game where it was 3-0, but, you know, over the course of the season, once he got his sharpness back and everything, he was just unbelievable that season.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it, Stephen? I mean, you can always talk about managers, and they'll always get transfers right, and they'll always get transfers wrong. And you know, you look at even someone like Arsene Wenger, who sort of the first half of his career at Arsenal couldn't seem to put a foot wrong, and then as time went on, he was perceived to make a few errors. But certainly, you know, Alex Ferguson was never one to to rush or panic by. You know, and Dan's made a great point there about Dwight York, and you know, it would seem, and I can remember the. You know, when the sale went through, and thinking, I'm not sure there, as you know, as Dan's mentioned as well. But yeah, it turned out to be the right players at the right time.
Yeah, timing's everything, and I fully agree with that sentiment about Dwight York, is that you weren't entirely certain if he was Manchester United quality. Well, was he? He was great for Aston Villa. He was prolific. I think there was that sense of individualistic nature about him that perhaps just made you think, was he, would he have it to be able to play within a team set up, you know, such an encompassing team set up of a team at the very top that's challenging for honours. It was just whether he could take that extra step, and there was a doubt whether he could do that. But it's that concept of seeing something in a player and being sold on the concept that he can actually do it, he can actually fit in there. And I think you've got to look as well into it, is that he was such a stark contrast to Eric Cantona, for instance. You know, Cantona, for all his excesses and the downsides of Cantona, on the pitch, Cantona was a consummate team player. There was no doubt about his commitment to the collective. It wasn't about the individual on the pitch. You know, he was quirky off the pitch. That fantastic personality of his that, you know, I've come to love over the years. And just last week when he was picking up that award was just absolute brilliance. You know, absolutely, you know, love that side of him. So you had Dwight York, and it was a very different kind of complexion all of a sudden, and this is why it jarred, I think. Certainly jarred in a, on a playing sense, but just in a sensory manner as he arrived at the club.
It was, I mean, like I say, when you mention some of the names, you know, that Dan's mentioned there that they were associated with, and you know, for Dwight York to be the one, you know, the one that Ferguson chose to buy. I suppose, Dan, you know, this is an era where, you know, that this class of 92 were absolutely, you know, at their prime, at their peak. But in terms of youth then, because, you know, I know Manchester United are very, very good at promoting youth, and certainly in that era they were very good at promoting youth. Is there anybody who sort of came into this side, you know, via the, I suppose, the academy, if you like, the academy setup?
The only real one was Wes Brown. He, you know, he didn't have a massive part to play in the season, but he was definitely around, and he was definitely making his name. I think he made his debut against Leeds, and then he played... I remember he played away at Brondby in the group stages of the Champions League, played right back, and he was brilliant. You know, he got up and down. I know he was sort of a centre-half, really, and he played most of his sort of later career there. But when he first broke into the team at the age of 18, he was like a sort of bombing down the wing right back, and really adventurous going forward with the ball. And, pretty local lad as well from Longsight, so... It was great to see him get in the team and do well, but apart from that, it was, you know, mainly the sort of class of 92 lads.
I'm quite. This is a side issue now. I'm really sorry, Dan. It's a side issue question, and to be fair, it might apply to you as well, Stephen. You know, when you're obviously coming from, you know, Liverpool, Manchester, or, you know, and supporting these big clubs, are you? And certainly in that time, looking back 20 years ago, and, you know, when you were younger as well, Stephen, is the city or are the fans aware of young players coming through as the press seem to sort of, you know, build them up about these child prodigies? But are you as fans aware of these players before they break into the first team?
Yeah, you are. You know, if you're a watcher of your own team, and, you know, way back when, it just used to be a case of picking a programme and you would scan through the reserves and the results and who was playing, who was, you know, what the goals ratios were. You might, you know, at Liverpool, they would play reserve games at Anfield. So, you know, if you weren't going to an away game, you could just walk into Anfield for very cheap or free and watch, you know, interesting reserve games, because you would have those kids playing. Those upcoming kids playing with players, for, you know, experienced first team players that were out of the picture, isn't like it is now, where you have an under 21 or under 23 side that is effectively your reserve side. What we had back then was that there was no age specific, and the old Central League, you know, you would have players who were in the mid, you know, late 20s, early 30s, who'd fallen out of favour or that were coming back from injury. So you had that mix of big names who were fighting the way back or trying to get into the first team again, alongside these youngsters who were coming through. So you would be aware of them, yeah.
Yeah, I think obviously it's not as easy as it is today, where you have sort of Twitter and, you know, it's a lot easier now. I mean, most people will know most of the players in their kind of, you know, under 23 team or whatever. You know, you'll know who they are. So there's not really a lot of intrigue. I think, you know, you did know who people were, but it definitely wasn't on the level that it is today. And for me, when I could drive, the great thing was that I could go to the training ground on a Saturday morning and watch the under-18s, you know. So that's a really good way to keep an eye on the sort of next generation, if you like.
The only reason why, obviously, you know, we talked about the class of 92, but I would assume, and you'll know far better than me, Dan, but I'm guessing there would be, you know, having produced such a young crop of talented players, you know, around 92 and leading up to this 98-99 season, I would imagine the interest in Manchester United's youth setup was obviously a lot greater based on what had come sort of the previous years. That's why I was asking.
Yeah, I think that kind of class of 92 is almost like a gift and a curse, really, in terms of football, because, you know, everyone expects that everyone that comes after that will be of the same calibre. You know, I think it was just a kind of freak year, a bit like at Barcelona when they had Messi and Piqué and Fabregas in the same team, you know. But yeah, I think you're right. It, to be honest, it's always been a sort of, it's always been a key tenet of the club's philosophy, really, the young players. So, you know, I think more than a lot of clubs, there's much more sort of awareness and pride in getting those young lads out. I can't remember how many years it is, but it's something like 80 odd years where there's been at least one youth product in each match day squad. So, you know, carrying on the tradition, really. But obviously, the quality is going to vary year on year.
It's funny, there's a Twitter account, and it might even be the Youth Academy, but there's an ongoing count, and it seems to pop up on my timeline every Saturday. There is this ongoing count of an academy player, you know, in the match day squad for the first team, and, you know, like you say, it must have been going for decades.
I think it's like 1937 or something like that.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible. So with regards then, you know, as we sort of come to this season then, Dan, were the noises from Alex Ferguson, were they any different? You know, did he feel, was he exuding a confidence that this season, or was he very wary of, like you say, what had gone on with Arsenal the season before? Was it a cautious Alex Ferguson at the start, or was it a very, you know, very confident and expectant Alex Ferguson?
I think, well, as everyone knows with Fergie, I think he's kind of like the sort of, you know, the cornered animal, isn't he? You know, whenever he's had a challenge, that's when he's been at his best. You know, he Arsenal was a challenge, and you could see that there was a bit of a defiance in him, that that he was, you know, he wasn't going to lie down and just take Arsenal becoming the new force. And he obviously the players that he brought in, the money that they spent, that was kind of, that was him fighting back as well. So I think there was a really kind of like a renewed vigour about him, that he wasn't going to wilt and that he was going to come out fighting.
It's like I say, I mean, I'm a lot older than you, Dan, clearly now. I've just established. And, you know, and Steve was mentioned at the beginning, and, you know, these sort of memories. And I tried to think back, I was looking at this, as to whether you know, looking at Alex Ferguson season on season, but he was, like, you know, you mentioned a great point there, you know, he was like a wounded animal, a cornered animal, if there'd been a threat to, Manchester United's dominance. But he was very... he always came across to me as being, you know, very consistent in terms of his expectations, you know, in terms of his, how he set about at the start of every season. It was almost this metronomic sort of persona that he would put on at the start of every season. And like I say, I was, you know, sort of looking back at this and whether there was anything different going into this season, and... You know, I couldn't find anything. Obviously, you know, you would know better than me. But more interestingly, the season after, it still didn't seem any different. He still didn't seem any different to me either.
Oh, he's just a again, it's a bit of a cliche, but he's just a natural born winner, isn't he? You know, you win something, then you press reset, and you know the next day it's forgotten. You know, Roy Keane was kind of the same. You know, many people said he was like the on pitch personification of Ferguson, but they were both the same. You know, they might have a few pints after a victory, or whiskies or red wine or whatever Ferguson drinks. And but the next day it'd be almost forgotten. You know, like no time to enjoy it really. No time to sort of sit there looking at the medals on the mantelpiece. It was just press reset and go again the next day. Regardless, you know, win, lose or draw, it's the same kind of standard, the same demands, the same expectations.
I mean, obviously, you know, we joked at the beginning, you know, Stephen being a Liverpool fan and yourself being a Manchester United fan, but I suppose, Stephen, you know, you've got to admit and respect, I mean, this was the Liverpool way, wasn't it, in the 70s and 80s, you know, what Dan's just said there, you could almost read for Shankly, Bob Paisley, Joe Fagan, you know, it was just that, like Dan said, that play the season, win, reset, go again.
Yeah, like I said earlier on, there's that mirror image, you know, ethos going on there. You know, I might never have admitted it, but I think Ferguson took a lot of how Paisley ran his Liverpool and implemented it to not just his Manchester United, but his Aberdeen as well. It was that concept of normalising success, you know, not making such a huge big deal out of it. I think there's an infamous bit of footage from his Aberdeen days where they'd won one of the domestic cups in Scotland, and rather than celebrating, he's absolute doing his nut in front of a camera over, you know, the sloppy way that they ended the game, you know, and he's properly irate. And I think that's, you know, something that I've never seen before or since in a cup-winning manager. And yeah, he did. He just had that concept of this. Yeah, you've won, but there's your medal, and you know that's done and dusted. We move on to the next one, and it's exactly what Liverpool used to do. Joe Fagan used to be, you know, synonymous for, he'd walk into the dressing room with a box full of the Championship winners' medals. He'd ask players, so did you play 13 games last season? If it was a no, he didn't throw one to them. If it was a yes, he'd throw a medal, and that was it. That was as ceremonial as Liverpool got in handed out the Championship winners' medals. It was just a case of normalising it and saying, yeah, this is what we should be doing. No, this isn't exceptional. This is what we're meant to be doing. And Ferguson, you know, replicated that.
Well, there was just to sort of go a little bit off topic, wasn't it Clough when he went to Leeds that he sort of told them all to,
throw all your medals in the bin because you cheated for them. That was the Clough introduction to the Leeds squad. Yeah,
just going in sort of stark contrast though. You know, you mentioned Ferguson and Keane and that kind of that winning mentality and, you know, press reset and go again kind of thing. I might be jumping the gun a bit here in sort of timelines, but Keane said in his first book that he looked around the changing room in Barcelona on the night of the Champions League, and he sort of said that he could see you know, that certain players were kind of, you know, that they were happy with that, that they could finish the career because they were never going to top that. Whereas obviously he was, obviously it might be exacerbated by the fact that he missed the game through suspension, but, you know, some players were kind of almost like they reached the peak of the mountain.
Yeah, you do get that where they've reached that mountain and they can't go any further. You know, at Liverpool, the same similar thing happened in 81 after winning against Real Madrid in 81. Ray Clements moved on for a different challenge at Tottenham. You know, there's almost a boredom within success for some players.
Yeah.
And they need the stimulation of a different environment and a different challenge. Maybe the removal of pressure in winning, you know, the biggest prizes all the time. Maybe there was something in that with, you know, because he could mirror again. There's another mirror image because Peter Schmeichel left after that 1999 Champions League victory. So, you know, his need for something different was there. You know, he played on for a good few years. He could have carried on at Manchester United in the same way that Clements could have carried on at Liverpool.
Yeah, I think the two players that I'll touch on now is Dwight York. He was one. He was unreal that season. He, in terms of goals and assists, I think he got something like 55. Got, you know, combined goals and assists. But he was never, ever the same, and he left the club about a year later. I think he was the prime example of not having that kind of...
There is that exhaustion in success. You know, some players seem to be programmed to have one success, whereas others are driven for more and more and more, like a Roy Keane was. But, you know, for Roy Keane, you know, another Graeme Souness, basically, in that respect, there is that drive to win more and more and more. And a player like that cannot understand why those surrounding him don't feel the same way and don't share that inbuilt desire and need for more.
Well, just touching on Schmeichel. Schmeichel actually announced that he would be leaving sort of, I think it was in November, before the season, you know, well before the sort of season like came to a sort of crescendo. He was really struggling physically with the amount of games, and he had a bit of a poor spell of form. And he even got sent to Barbados for a couple of weeks to just get out of the limelight because he was coming under a bit of fire. And I think physically he was just struggling to cope. Obviously, then, like you say, he ended up coming back playing for City a couple of years later. So he kind of contradicted himself there. But I think it was less to do with sort of his lack of, you know, or his sort of happiness with how things were. It was already planned.
You've touched all, you know, on Schmeichel and York, and we've mentioned Keane and stuff, and the new players in. But I suppose, you know, this is that we've sort of reached the point we usually get here around the sort of half an hour mark, and we're dead on. So if you just want to introduce, Dan, your principal 1 to 11, then for this act, you can do it in any way that you want.
Okay, so yeah, Schmeichel in there. You had Gary Neville at the right back, Jaap Stam centre half, pretty much always. Mainly played with Ronnie Johnson, but Henning Berg was also he played, you know, a fair number of games as well. Dennis Irwin at left back, Beckham on the right, Giggs on the left, Keane Scholes in the middle, and then York and Cole up front. In terms of other players that were sort of milling around in the squad and contributing quite heavily, but just not in that first 11. You've got Nicky Butt, Phil Neville, we've already mentioned Blomqvist and Brown, and then you've got Sheringham, Solskjaer, obviously those two are quite important, and then, like I say, Henning Berg. So they were the sort of, I would say, you know, principal sort of 18 players that would feature in most matchday squads.
I mean, that the sort of the 1 to 11 that you name, you know, and obviously the, you know, sort of the famous four strikers that Ferguson had, and the need for four strikers. But in terms of this 1 to 11, as a Manchester United fan, I know hindsight's a great thing, but at the time, would that have been your first choice 1 to 11 as well, that you mentioned there?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. There's not... You know, I was a huge fan of Andy Cole, even when he was at Newcastle. And then obviously York comes in, the big money signing, so that's going to be your favourite front two. But the best thing about that squad was that there were so, you know, it was for the time, you know, 18 players doesn't, like now 18 players doesn't seem like a deep squad, but then I think it was. And there was just a lot of quality on that bench. You know, you could probably put in those seven players that I mentioned there that aren't in the starting 11, and you know, you put them seven with another four, you can have a strong team regardless.
I mean, it is, Stephen, isn't it? You know, it is an iconic side, and you know, that's why we do these. Although, you know, people choose their own sides, but you know, this is, you know, you can't argue this is one of the most iconic sides, you know, in English football. And you know, Dan's mentioned it's, you know, it's only 18, which doesn't seem a lot in this day and age, but you know, he's absolutely right, isn't he? That you could play any combination of that 18 and have a wonderful side.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you're just edging towards that era of, you know, the squad era. You know, I think we're just on the dying cusp of that kind of like 1-11 week in, week out. And as Dan's already mentioned there, you know, Schmeichel was sent off to Barbados for a bit of rest and recuperation for a little bit. And but yeah, other players across the squad would start to creep in to cover for games. You know, I think you could go back to kind of like the early to mid-1990s when Ferguson started to play youth products in League Cup games, you know, up until then that even that wasn't, you know, a breeding ground for throwing in your reserves. You know, full-strength sides were still put out in League Cup games up until, you know, the mid-1990s. It was a bit of a culture shock almost when these huge wholesale changes of sides were made, and quite controversial at the time. But even so, you know, it didn't continue into league games and FA Cup games and even kind of like European games that were done and dusted. It still tended to be, you know, strongest sides put out. And yes, this Manchester United side with kind of like, you know, six or seven sat on the sidelines who, you know, were competed for a place on the bench, let alone in the side, because you know what were we at that time? Were we three substitutes that were allowed in domestic games? So you know you were in that concept of players sat in the stand watching games who probably would have walked into the vast majority of the teams in the Premier League.
I mean, you know, we've gone through this list of players here, Dan. I'm quite. We mentioned him right at the start, coming back from injury, Roy Keane, and Roy Keane now is, I wouldn't say he's quite a divisive figure, but certainly his comments are, he doesn't sit on the fence. But in terms of a captain, obviously he took over from Cantona. Where do you, or how did you see him as a, never mind as a footballer, but how did you see him as a captain for your side?
I just, I absolutely idolised him, you know, growing up in the 90s. He, for me, like, As a football fan, and even, you know, when you play the game yourself, you know, even at a sort of grassroots level, you look around the sort of changing room or you look at the sort of starting lineup, and there's just certain players that you just feel more comfortable with when they're in the team. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And
he's that one when he stood there at the front in the tunnel just before the game, and you know, he always used to sort of take a big gulp of air and sort of puff his chest out kind of thing, you know. Kind of like a sort of fighting stance almost, you know, the sort of, you know, the posture. You just kind of felt safe. I know it sounds really daft, but you just kind of, you know, everything's going to be all right if he's leading the team out. And that's how I felt about him. There was quite an interesting thing during that season that I remember it being quite big news. I think it would be absolutely massive news now with the sort of Twitter generation. But he was kind of fighting with the club over a new contract. It was sort of in the December, I think it was. And I remember £52,000 was the sort of the figure being bandied around, that he was kind of demanding, you know, and it was like, wow, that's a lot of money, you know, that is, he's going to be the club's highest paid player, you know. Nowadays, I think people would say he's holding the club to ransom, but, you know, back then it was, I think a lot of the fans were backing him, you know, how important he was. And that, you know, they needed to sort of get with the times a bit in terms of wages they paid. So, and he signed his new contract like just before a Bayern Munich game in the group stages, and fittingly scored a goal to sort of seal it. But I remember that being really big news. But yeah, he was just an unbelievable player and the driving force of the team. Like I said earlier, the sort of on-pitch embodiment of everything Ferguson stood for.
It's funny, mate. We talked about this in a couple of these episodes, where you know the sort of almost symbiotic relationship between a manager and captain, and how one is the embodiment of the other. And you're right. You know, Roy Keane was almost Alex Ferguson, if you like, but on the pitch and in a far younger body. In terms of the season, then, key games, key moments. That, I mean, you know, when you go on to win the amount of trophies they won in this season, you know, there was a lot of key moments. But for you, as a 15-year-old fan looking back, which for you were the key moments of this season?
Well, I've already mentioned the Charity Shield. So just on a personal note, it was a great experience for me to go to the old Wembley. It was quite key in the sense that, you know, it was the first game after Arsenal had dominated the season before and then they go and win 3-0. So I think to start the season like that and then come back the way the team did was, you know, just a testament to everyone's character, really. The very first game of the season, on paper, it's just a boring 2-2 draw with Leicester. But I think a couple of interesting key points for me is that Leicester went 2-0 up and Beckham equalised in the Sheringham scored. Beckham assisted that one. And then Beckham scored a free kick in the 94th minute. So it not only prevented a sort of defeat on the opening day of the season, but the important thing for me for two reasons, that goal. Beckham was just coming home from the World Cup where he got sent off against Argentina, the incident with Simeone. And throughout that whole season, he was subjected to some pretty vile abuse, most notably at West Ham, where they hung up effigies of him, and the national papers were all sort of in on the act as well, criticising him. And the character he showed that season was absolutely unbelievable. And for him to sort of, you know, get an assist and then a late goal just, you know, shows the character of the lad. And also the fact that he was a late goal, you know, late goals were a really key part of that season. So you've got sort of two really interesting points just wrapped up in one goal there. What else have we got next? Trying to think what the next ones were. There was Southampton, again, another sort of on paper, just a sort of run-of-the-mill 3-0 defeat, but it was actually the first game where Cole and York kind of got a run together. It's funny because Cole and York almost feels like it was Ferguson's last choice partnership. I remember when York signed, he played with Solskjaer first, and then he was partnered by Sheringham, and then Cole kind of got in third. You know, it was almost like Ferguson was trying every other combination, you know, without using Andy Cole. I don't know if that's how it was or whether it was just circumstances, but that's kind of how it felt at the time, you know, that Cole was kind of being sidelined. But they got together in the game against Southampton, both scored, and, you know, the rest is history, really, with that partnership. They just clicked and gelled, and they went on to have a really good partnership, and by all accounts were close off the field as well. Probably another key game, which is a defeat, but it's key because the Middlesbrough won at Old Trafford in December. They won 3-2, but that was the last time the team lost a game. So after that, it was 33 games unbeaten from December to the end of the season, which is pretty impressive. And it's almost like, you know, that, you know, you have those, whenever a team has a good season, you always have those kind of watershed moments, you know, where something goes wrong, because obviously you can't win every game. And that was that one there, really, where it sort of, after that, it was kind of enough's enough, you know, we're gonna kick into gear now. What else do we have? We have the Liverpool game, sorry Stephen, but the FA Cup round four, that was a 2-1 win at Old Trafford, but again, two late goals, Solskjaer and then York, I think it was. They, you know, we talked about late goals before, and that was another one of those games where it was just a massive moment. Stephen, you probably remember that game, but it was...
Yeah, I remember that day.
Yeah,
I can remember we played absolutely outstandingly for like 88 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
And then I think the defining image, apart from the late goals, was Paul Ince kind of walking off the pitch with about 10 minutes to go. He had a minor injury, and I think that's where you can go back to Roy Keane and that concept of a captain.
Yeah.
You know, being so, you know, soothing almost and reassuring. And Paul Ince at that time was the polar opposite, you know, in a Liverpool shirt on that day. You know, that he could have played through the pain barrier. you know, over those final few minutes, and then, you know, he didn't, and remember that game very, very well.
I think I don't want to talk about Paul Ince because I don't want my blood pressure to go up. So I'm just trying to think of the other important games, really. You had the 8-1 at Nottingham Forest. That's quite famous, where Solskjaer scored 4 goals. You know, he's obviously the manager now, but as a player, he was, you know, you talk about having nice lads in the dressing room and sort of, you know, good characters. And for him to know that he's kind of not the first choice and to come on like he used to do, and you know, the amount of goals he got from the bench was unbelievable. Funny thing about that is that Jim Ryan on the bench told him to keep it simple when he came on, because it was already 4-1. He didn't think he would get on because York and Cole had both bagged a brace each. And Jim Ryan just said, look, keep it simple, you know, we're 4-1 up, just go out there and kind of almost like not go through the motions, but do you know what I mean? He went out and scored 4, so that was a pretty pretty interesting one. The Arsenal game, that was just a couple of games later, that was 1-1 at Old Trafford. That was a big moment as well, because Arsenal were winning 1-0 till quite late on. I remember that night really well, and it was absolutely chucking it down. The pitch was an absolute quagmire. And Arsenal were 1-0 up for ages. York missed a pen, and Andy Cole equalised quite late on. I think it was quite late on anyway, but it felt like it was. But yeah, that was a key game, because, you know, the league was so tight that had Arsenal gone and won that game, psychologically as well, winning at Old Trafford, then I think the rest of the season would have panned out very differently. What else do we have? We have Champions League games, obviously, you know, Inter Milan. You know, you look at the teams. I mean, some teams win the Champions League and it sounds daft, but they have quite an easy run. Or, you know, they kind of get a good draw, you know, luck of the draw. But to face Bayern Munich and Barcelona in the group stages, and then Inter Milan in the quarterfinals, and then Juventus in the semis, and then Bayern Munich again, like me, I mean, that is some list of European heavyweights. So the games against Inter and Juve, they were really memorable. Inter was Beckham coming back face to face with Simeone, which was quite. I remember that being big news at the time. And Beckham had the last laugh in the game at Old Trafford. It was 2-0, 2 carbon copy goals, York headers, and Beckham supplied the crosses for both of those. One of my favourite things from that Inter Milan game as well at Old Trafford was Jaap Stam. There's like a moment with Zamorano. Do you remember the Chilean striker, Ivan Zamorano, where he was sort of, he was walking backwards and kind of backing into Jaap Stam, and he just basically stood there with his chest puffed out, and Zamorano kind of just like walked into him and just bounced off him. I don't know if you remember it. I mean, maybe it's just me, because obviously I sort of lived it a little bit closer, but if you YouTube it, you'll probably see it, and it's just, it kind of, with hindsight, with all the years later, it kind of almost feels like a moment where Jaap Stam was kind of like, you know, I've arrived. You know, he had a tough start to the season. And then, you know, here he is now, and it's March. You kind of get into the business end of the season, and he's dominating some of the best strikers in the world. So that was a great moment. I think, and then from there on in, really, you start, you know, just mentioned the sort of phrase business end, but every game just felt massive then, you know, and every game just felt like a must win, you know. FA Cup games, there was the Arsenal, then we get to Juventus at home, then you've got the Arsenal FA Cup semi-finals, the replay. The first game was pretty dull, and I don't know if it's just by comparison with the replay, but it was just a drab game. It was 0-0. Keane scored, but it got disallowed. And then, you know, like a few days later, you've got this game, which is just one of the best games of all time, really, because it just had absolutely everything. Villa Park, you know, we talked about Villa Park on the FA Cup podcast we did back in May. But, you know, just had, you know, had Villa Park, it was the floodlights, it had, they missed the penalty, Bergkamp missed the penalty, and Elkred a goal disallowed, you know, Keane got sent off. It just had absolutely everything. And then, of course, that goal by Giggs, you know, it's one of the most memorable goals of all time, really. Started with a bit of a exhausted pass from Vieira, and then he just ran through about five or six players. Obviously, you've got the Juventus game, which was about a week later or so. Juventus had got a 1-1 draw from Old Trafford a couple of weeks before. Giggs had scored a late goal in that game, so if it wasn't for that goal, then it would be game over. But that kind of goal was gives you the hope then. Then you go to Turin and Juventus are 2-0 up after 10 minutes, both goals by Inzaghi. And you think, bloody hell, because Juventus at that time were the sort of kings of Europe, weren't they, really, Juve? I think, was it they'd been to the last three finals and won one of them?
Yeah.
They were, in the late 90s, they were the team, they were the team to beat. And they go 2-0 up at home, they've got an away goal. And you just think, wow, bloody hell, this is going to be tough. But the character of the team that night was just unbelievable. And Keane got the party started with a header just before half time, I think it was. And it's like Gazza in 1990 when he got booked against Germany. And knew he'd missed the final, but still kind of went out and did everything he could to get his team to the final. And that's what Keane did. And then York and Cole then get a goal each, and unbelievable. I think it was sort of like around that time, with the Arsenal game, the Juventus game, that people were really starting to think that the treble was a possibility. It made me laugh last season, when all the journalists were talking about City winning the quadruple. I don't know, maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't remember there being that much kind of talk about it before the sort of the season really sort of got to sort of climax. Whereas the journalists last season were sort of talking about City winning the quadruple in October, I think it felt like. And then I think you've got. I remember a feisty 2-2 draw at Anfield, where we won't talk about Ince, but Ince scored and celebrated like an absolute madman. Irwin got sent off by David Ellery and would miss the FA Cup final. That was quite a big game. Did Liverpool come back from 2-0 down that night, Steve? I can't remember.
They did.
It was a good comeback. It was
quite an electric night from a Liverpool perspective. It was just a standalone game, basically. It had no burden on the rest of the season for us, but it was a standalone game and a massive occasion and an electric atmosphere. It was a hell of a night. Yeah.
I bet was there some kind of let's beat these and stop them winning the league kind of thing. I'm sure it was.
I don't think we had any kind of designs on stopping winning. Well, it would have been a nice side effect, but at the same time, I think the focus at Anfield that night was just on winning.
That
individual game. I can't remember any particular chat about let's do them to knock them off the stride or anything like that. It was just simply, let's go out there and beat them. Yeah.
And I think after that, then you've got the sort of the culmination of the season. Those three key games, 10 days. I just remember the sort of feeling. It was kind of like, Christmas had come early. Every couple of days there was a big game with the trophy on the line. It's unbelievable, really. I mean, you see it in other seasons. Seasons where teams win a couple of trophies, but they might win the league, and then they've got at City last season. They won the league sort of with a couple of weeks to go, didn't they? And then you've got a bit of a gap, but it just felt like every single game in that last 10 days was every single game was a cup final. You had three cup finals in 10 days, and as a kid and as a football fan, it was just. It was like I say, Christmas had come early. You had Spurs at home in the league. It was the final game of the league season. They went 1-0 up. Beckham scored. And then Andy Cole scored an absolutely brilliant goal to seal it. The ball came over his shoulder and he sort of took it down. And then Ian Walker came out and he just lifted it over him. Absolutely brilliant goal from Andy Cole. Massive fan of him, always was. And I was so happy for him that he got that kind of big goal. There'd always been that talk about him after what Hoddle said, and I think that was another one of those games where he just proved just how good he was, when the pressure was on. And then you've got the FA Cup final came next, Newcastle. Really, it was quite a routine win. I think it was you know, in the grand scheme of things, it was probably, it was nice that that was kind of in the middle. You know, it kind of gave the team a little bit of a breather before the Champions League final, because it was just an easy day at the office, really. Keane and Scholes played because they weren't going to be playing in the final. But actually, Keane getting injured was what sort of turned the game, really. Gary Speed, it was that fouled him. Keane had to go off, end of his season. Sheringham came on, then he was crucial to the game. He ended up scoring and assisting as well. Best part about the FA Cup final was when the trophy was being presented and Shearer was like begrudgingly clapping on the pitch, looking like he just didn't want to be there. That's quite a pleasant moment for me. And then you've got the Bayern Munich game in the final. You know, we talked earlier about the squad and the importance of the squad. With Keane and Scholes being out, that was massive that day. You know, when you look at the team on paper that day, you kind of think, oh, bloody hell, because it was Beckham and Butt in midfield, I think. And then you had Giggs on the right and Blomqvist on the left, if my memory serves me right. So you kind of look at that midfield and think, oh, I don't fancy that, really. And Bayern were probably the better team. You know, they scored the early goal, they hit the post, they hit the bar. And, you know, on the balance of play, they probably deserve to win, really. But as we know, that's not how it works. And, yeah, the two late goals, which have just been replayed and done to death, especially Solskjaer's, you know, with him coming back as the manager now, that kind of got a bit of a fresh airing when he took the job. But yeah, I mean, what a way to end the season. What a 10 days.
We've done a few episodes of these now. You know, and we sort of wait, don't we, Stephen, for the passion to come through, and you can hear it, and you can hear it in Dan's there as the season built. You could hear that, almost like he was reliving it and the excitement. But yeah. I think we've looked at the season. Certainly, you know, the last one we did, which was Barcelona. But I think in terms of this particular season, this particular side, and I think Dan's absolutely right. You look at two quarterfinals against Inter Milan, two semi-final games against Juventus, the two semi-finals against Arsenal, then the FA Cup final, the league decider, the Champions League final. There was almost, really, that's 10 games just right there where, and I know to win a treble, you need luck and you need good fortune and, you know, you have to beat what's in front of you to win these trophies. But this season was anything but a procession. To me, it seemed like, you know, they really went to the very depths of the talent, of the squad, of the manager, of the belief. You know, this wasn't a processional season. It was almost a season of attrition by the time it got to the end.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to sort of another thought that I've got in my head is, you know, you look at that season and then the following season was, I think we finished something like 18 points clear of Arsenal. It was a record that was only just topped by City last year. They finished 19 points clear. No, not last year. The year before, was it? They finished 19 points clear. And people forget that, you know, because in the 1999-2000 season, United finished, 18 points clear of Arsenal. And people forget that. And the reason is because it's not always about sort of points, is it? It's kind of the memories that you make. And That, and you know, all those games you just reeled off there, Stu, in the space of, 8 weeks, that even though on points, you know, you didn't finish as many points clear as your rival, because of the memories you make and the sort of big games, and that makes the season, really, rather than a season where you just walk it and finish, you know, 15 points clear or whatever.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Stephen, even you as a Liverpool fan, you know, you couldn't, if you were a fan of football, and certainly if you were living in England, you're a fan of English football. I mean, that was a season, and Dan's right, where there seemed to be a big game from March onwards. It seemed that every game that Manchester United were involved in was huge, with massive implications.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was you know, you couldn't call it anything other than impressive. You know, yes, they rode the luck at times, but you know, when a team's that focused and that good, it's a cliche, but you create your own luck. You only have to look at how they went from, you know, running through Arsenal in that FA Cup semi-final replay, you know, dealing with Juventus in the way that they did. There was no luck involved in those games. Yes, there might have been luck that created that platform for them at times, but like I say, you've got to be determined and focused enough to create that look and to turn what seemed to be, you know, lost causes into winning situations. And when a team's that good and achieving something like that, there's no real thing. There is no such thing as luck as such.
And I think as well, Stephen, Dan's right when, you know, he mentioned Manchester City. I mean, what was it? Just about 18 months ago? I'm sure there were standout memories, and I'm sure there was elements of Manchester City's football. It's like, oh, that was brilliant. Oh, that was wonderful. But even two decades later, which is how we started all this, there are still games and moments that you can pick out from that whole Manchester United season.
Well, yeah, it's that knife edge. It's that tightrope that you walk in. One false move and it can all go wrong, or, you know, you can throw it away. And you don't get that when you win the league title by 15, 18, 19 points, whatever it is. It's those moments, that goal, that piece of individual brilliance that turned one point into three, that made the difference, that won back a lost cup tie, and, you know, that turned something round. And you simply don't have that when you run away with a league title. Yes, it's impressive. Yes, there's some, you know, artistic beauty to be found there, but there's no soul in that, you know. And I'm not begrudging any team. I've seen Liverpool win league titles by comfortable margins, but Dan is correct. Those aren't the victories and the successes that live the longest in the memory and burn the brightest. It's the ones that are won by the skin of your teeth and by that bravery and endeavour that is needed to defeat that foe and to be able to just stretch out and just about reach that success. They're the ones that live long in the memory.
And I think it's also, sorry, Stu, I think it's that, you know, the rivalry is key, isn't it? You know, that you kind of, you need it. To make something exciting in sport, you need a rival.
You need a foe. It's, you know, you can look at boxing, for instance, and, you know, how consummately ruthless Mike Tyson was at the peak of his powers. But, you know, it's not as interesting as like the Hagler Hearns and Leonard era and Duran era of the 1970s and 80s, where they were all so closely entwined and fights that could have gone any way. Or in tennis, you know, the Sampras era bored me senseless. But, you know, when I was a kid growing up, watching kind of like McEnroe, Borg and Connors going at it, and then later on you have, you know, even down to kind of like Lendl and Edberg, Willander and Becker and all those, it always is that sense of rivalry and the being, you know, a face-off and some kind of, you know, head to head, and that's what makes it.
Well, you'll know from last season, you know, that, I mean, back then obviously it was a bit different, but, you know, like now, you know, last season, you know, Liverpool fans, City fans, you know, that every game they'd be sort of checking Twitter and checking their sort of like live score app and, you know, like, oh, you know, let's see how they got on, and, you know, hoping that they slip up
Yeah, you know, it's exactly what it is. You know, you need that running mate almost. To provoke that brilliance, you know, the successes that are run away with and foregone conclusions, you know, they're hard earned. Yes, you have to be brilliant to achieve that, but you need someone to push you. You need that rival. You need that team that's breathing right down your neck, where you are one mistake away from losing it and throwing it all away.
Yeah, but I mean, put it this way, you know, I've got. From that sort of era, I've got all the, you know, the end of season DVD things that clubs bring out, and the one from the following season where it was the league was won at a canter, you know, I've probably watched it, like, you know, I can count on one hand the amount of times I've watched it. But the treble DVD, you know, it's absolutely knackered, it's stretched.
Yeah, because I mean, you can you know, watch footage, or you can think back to, you know, a campaign like that when it's your own team. And Even now, you can look at something and take a sharp intake of breath, because somehow in your you know, you remember how that felt, and that's what it comes down to. It is, you remember how it felt, and you think and you can almost watch the footage and still think that you got a balls it up, even though you won that success 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, whatever it is. You know, it can still give you that little knot in your stomach and think, what if, you know, that ball had been played the opposite direction, or you know that decision went against, or whatever it is, you know, it can still stir the soul.
It's like watching a film, you know, that you know the outcome, but it's so brilliant that you know you're kind of still going along the roller coaster as if you know it could all go wrong.
Yeah, that sense of peril is it, they're not going to make it back this time, or whatever it is. It's just something that stirs the soul.
We're over the hour, and you know there's no surprise. I think everyone's gone over the hour. But one thing for you both to think about. You know, I always like to end with your single standout. And I know, having just said what we've all just said, this is going to be really difficult. But if you can try and come up with your single standout memory from the season, that would be great. But before I ask you both that, Dan, last question really, and this is probably the question that always interests me the most, and that's the legacy of this side. But you know, we're two decades down the line, you know. Alex Ferguson's gone. We've seen the comings and goings through the managerial door that a whole generation of Manchester United fans are just unfamiliar with. So, in terms of legacy, then, you know, what do you think is the legacy of this side?
Well, I think you know the fact that we're sort of sat here now doing this podcast, you know, tells a story. It's 20 years on, I think, and I think it will be still talked about in sort of 30, 40, 50 years. It's probably the you know iconic side of Ferguson's era. You know, yeah, I mentioned before that a lot of people regard the 94 team as being stronger. You know, you've got the teams later down the line, sort of 2002, 2003. That was a good team, and then you had the sort of years with the European Cup final, three European Cup finals, 2007 to 2011. You know, where you had like Rooney in the team, people like Ferdinand. You know, that was another great team, but this for me is the kind of peak of Ferguson's time at United, which, you know, stretching 26 years, you know, it's hard to sort of pinpoint that one sort of mountain. But I think, you know, if you had to, you would probably say that. And I also think it's almost like a measure that club, I mean, you know, we mentioned before about City and the quadruple, you know, clubs are still trying to kind of top that season, you know. Maybe it's more from a sort of fan or journalistic point of view, but clubs are still looking to kind of have that kind of season, you know, whether they want to admit it or not. You know, every fan of every big team that's going for trophies would love to have that season where not only they win everything, but they make those memories. And I think that's one of the great legacies of it. In terms of on the pitch, it was, you know, like we talked about before, they didn't sit on the laurels. You know, that was the first of three consecutive league titles. I think it was the first time that had been done since Liverpool in the early 80s. And City on course for their third in a row this year if they win. So you know, it shows that it's quite a rare feat. So you know the side kept on cracking on and you know. Pretty much dominated on and off for the next kind of 10, 15 years under Ferguson.
I mean, obviously, Stephen, you know, we talk about the great Liverpool sides of the sort of late 70s. There are always eras, there are always periods of domination. You know, we've talked about potentially entering one with Manchester City, but I think Dan's absolutely right. It doesn't matter, you can call it a quadruple, you can call it what you like, and it's the winning of all domestic trophies, which is great. But the European Cup, as you and I like to call it, and the Champions League, you know, that's still a barometer, isn't it, of a great side. And it takes a great side to win the European Cup, but to win the European Cup and the slog that is the domestic championship and the luck that's required to win out to win a knockout cup as well. You know, it kind of puts it all into context this season, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. You know, you only have to point to the fact that not many teams have done that. You know, no matter what the nation, no matter what the domestic league, you know, it's such a massive rarity. And you only have to look at Manchester City, despite all of their advantages in what has been, over a decade now of the ownership that the country enjoy. And they're still waiting for that first Champions League success, you know, and it's not an easy thing to do, you know, to go out there and win it, no matter what the era was, whether it's, you know, the era that we have today or as it was back then when you had to win your league title to be involved in that competition. And yeah, it's such a massive thing to do, and it's a huge barometer of how good that Manchester United side was and how driven that Ferguson was. You know, the only thing I would add to that is that they didn't manage to do it repetitively in the Champions League, which is something that Ferguson is, you know, has put his hand up. He wished his Manchester United could have, you know, won repetitive European Cups at that period of time, you know, to truly cement it as like Ajax did and Bayern Munich and Liverpool and Real Madrid, to have won those clusters of European Cups to validate a team in a it's almost like a historical sentence. It's not that they're not. No, that's the only thing that they didn't do. It's the only thing they didn't do, but this treble, you know, more than makes up for that, I feel.
I completely agree. It's, you know, you talk about on a domestic level as well that, you know, you can win the league, but you've got to go and retain it or win.
Yeah, winning something is one thing. Going out there and keeping hold of it is a complete matter. Manchester United did that in spades domestically. Yeah. Couldn't quite do it in Europe, which, you know, is probably the only regret that Ferguson has over the course of what has been, you know, quite a stunning career, really.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have thought on that night, you know, in Barcelona that you'd have to wait another 9 years for Europe.
No, that would be it, and it'd be a very different Manchester United and a very different football environment by then. What I would say about this Manchester United is when they won it, you know, football's belly button is almost going from innie to outie. You know, this is it's the Rubicon from, you know, a level playing field to a more tilted, dramatically tilted playing field where many of the rivals are simply swept away by gravity. You know, Manchester United after this are only really challenged from the middle of the first decade of the new millennium by the riches of Chelsea and eventually the riches of Manchester City. Even Arsenal have ebbed away. You know, it's mad to say it, but it's 15 years since Arsenal won the Premier League title. Puts it into context and just how much football changed over that period of time. But that Manchester United in the late 1990s, you know, teams could still challenge and fight for honours. You know, Newcastle came so close and challenged, you know, and Blackburn had won. So teams were still hovering. You know, Arsenal under Wenger didn't spend huge, vast quantities of cash like teams after them would do. You know, so I think that is another plus point of what Manchester United did at that period of time, and this particular Manchester United did.
I suppose, like I say, you know, it's something we could talk about all night, which is why we do this, but. The last thing then is, you know, is your standout moments. I'll let you have the last word, Dan. So we'll let Stephen go first. Your standout moment, Stephen.
I could mischievously say Paul Ince, but I won't.
Not for Dan's blood pressure.
I'd have to say Solskjaer's mad 4 goals in the last 10 minutes after playing from the bench at Forest. You know, that was against a Ron Atkinson, Nottingham Forest as well. And, you know, no matter who you supported, you know, you had to take your hat off to such an amazing but also bizarre occurrence as that.
OK, so Dan, you've now got the rest of this entire campaign other than Solskjaer's 4 goals. To pick as your standout moment. I don't envy you this one.
Can I have two?
Oh, go on then.
obviously you've got the European Cup final, but I think the two games that really stand out to me were the Arsenal game that we mentioned before, the semi-final replay. Like I say, it just had absolutely everything. And coming up against such a strong rival as well, you know, those Arsenal United clashes sort of at the peak of Wenger's powers, and you know, they were amazing. You know, it's a team that you kind of hated but, you know, begrudgingly admired in every aspect, and you know, when they came together it was pretty much always electric and full of drama, and that night was just unbelievable, and that was one of the first nights, I think, where people started to really think, you know, this treble could be on. I remember there was a pitch invasion at the end, and some guy comes on and he's got like a sort of poster that says now for the treble, and you know, you've got a couple of cups with made out of tin foil. You know, people were sort of, it was really sort of building up then, that kind of this treble talk. And then the other one is that Juventus one. You know, like I said, Juventus were the team to beat. It was almost like slaying the dragon, you know, finally after, you know, after all those years of Juventus sort of dominating the late 90s, to go and beat them was kind of almost like a, you know, the seal of approval on the greatness of a team. And yeah, it just kind of, after that game, it kind of felt just inevitable. You know, we'd played Bayern Munich in the group stages twice, and they were a decent team, but they weren't really anything that you would, you know, fear over the likes of Inter Milan and Juventus. But yeah, it was just a massive night that in Barcelona, sorry, in Turin.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, Dan, you were as good, if not better, as I knew you would be coming on this particular series. Thank you so much for finding the time and coming to join us.
Yeah, no, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Stu, for inviting me and Stephen for taking part.
Yeah,
no problem.
Just echo that. Cheers, Stephen, once again, for the calmness personified that you are on these podcasts, while all I'm doing is my little brain's whirring away trying to think of random questions that pop in my head while I'm sat here.
No, like I say, it's great to hear the passion of the guest and the love of the scene. You know, how can you not enjoy that?
Exactly. So all that's left is for me to thank the listeners and to say please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.